Welcome to UN Gender Focus. I'm Deanne Penn at the United Nations in New York. Coming up in this week's program, disconnection from past traditions, the greatest challenge affecting indigenous people, and how psychological treatment for refugee mothers also benefits their children. But first, crimes of sexual violence during South Sudan's brutal civil war have been so bad that they need to become a key focus of the reconciliation effort. That's the verdict of the UN Special Envoy on Wartime Sexual Violence, Zainab Bangoura. More than 2 million people have been displaced in the world's youngest country over the past 3 years of fighting and tens of thousands killed. A new unity government has been formed and a fragile peace deal is in the process of being implemented. Ms. Bangoura spoke to Ratko Petrovich in South Sudan.
I'm here to re-echo the voice of the Secretary General, the Security Council and members that what has happened is unacceptable. And the crimes that have taken place, especially against women, girls and boys, is unacceptable. On my last visit, I visited Bentiu. And I spoke to survivors, people who have been affected by sexual violence being committed in Bentiu. And I think in my statement when I left this country, I said this is one of the worst experiences I've ever got in my life because of a combination of reasons, the conditions in which the women live, the lack of services for the victims of sexual violence, and the lack of accountability mechanism. And I think that's what we're pushing for.
After first meetings, what are the expectations from the government?
It's still, I think the first thing that shocks you is that the government has just been formed, even as simple as complimentary cards, the ministers don't have because they are 3 days in the office. But at least it's important for them to realize how important this issue is. I've met the Minister of Foreign Affairs. I've met the Minister of State in the President's office because he's a high focal representative that actually represents the government in this issue. And they were very supportive. They were very happy. And I think they realize that they do have limitations and that crimes have been committed and they will help to work with us.
So in Sierra Leone, we had one way of addressing war crimes and especially these particular crimes that you referring to and working with. In Liberia, there was another issue. So what do you see as a resolution?
The international community has agreed that there has to be an accountability mechanism. They're working towards a hybrid court. The Human Rights Council has made recommendations. The African Union, I spoke to the legal counsel, I've been working with them within the last 2 years since I visited here on how we can work together. The consensus is there that the crimes that have been committed in southern Sudan are so bad that we really need to ensure that it becomes part of the reconciliation and the peace-building process. Peace-building takes time. It's difficult for me to say we're out of the woods because the new government was just formed about a week ago. The ministers have just taken their offices. Working together itself creates tension and are actually areas of conflict. The important thing is the willingness of the parties to give peace a chance.
Disconnection from past traditions due to colonization is the greatest challenge that indigenous peoples must still overcome. That's according to Jandy Craig, a member of the White Mountain Apache tribe in Arizona in the southwest United States. She's been attending the latest session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, which opened this week at UN headquarters in New York. Janie Cangelosi spoke to Ms. Craig, who began by explaining the significance of the traditional dress she wore to the meeting.
I'm wearing an Apache camp dress that my aunt made for me, and I'm also wearing these blue and white prayer beads that I made, and also my tribal seal here. I also have turquoise and a purple stone here, and then I also have my feathers that I'm wearing there for my family and for my godchildren. And they all have white and blue stones, and that represents the men and women in my family. And it also represents the life that I live now, which is connected to the life that is after this life. I also have my Apache moccasins and my Apache medicine pouch, which has cedar in it that I collected actually from the Northwest because it's good for cooking.
Why do you think dress is such a significant part of cultural heritage?
Well, there's a lot of thought that goes into each piece that's made. Even my dress here, I know my aunt put a lot of prayer into it. And the way it comes together kind of represents the life that I am living and my intentions. So I think it's important for us to remember that everything is done with good intentions from the moment that we wake up in the morning. And the other thing that I think is important is before we create anything, we always have to think about it first. It's just like the same way that the world was created. You stop and you think about it. You think about the plan that you want to make. You make your prayer and then you go ahead and do it. And usually when you follow that protocol, it all comes out pretty well.
And what do you hope is discussed today at the forum?
Today I am hoping to discuss culture and the significance of the indigenous paradigm, how that can influence education and language. And ultimately, I mean, I know that they're all separate ideas, but they're all related to one thing, and that's, you know, the humanness that we all have, and also how we are, and as indigenous people and as people in general, we're connected to the land. So, for example, in my language, the same word for your mind is the same word for the land. Binit gojo, that means a blessed place. And so I feel like when people understand that paradigm, then a lot of other things fall into place. So that's kind of where it all begins.
What do you think are the most important issues facing Indigenous people today?
I think that disconnection between all those elements, the land, the language, the culture, the food, the way of life, there's a major disconnection from that. And a lot of it isn't necessarily our fault. You know, it's because of colonization.
Providing psychological treatment to traumatized refugee mothers can greatly improve their children's futures. That's according to Michael Wessels, professor in the program on forced migration and health at Columbia University in New York. He recently co-chaired the task force that developed a set of guidelines on mental health support in emergency settings initiated by the World Health Organization, WHO. Carmen Cuesta Roca spoke to Mr. Wessels and Bridget Khoury, a clinical psychologist at the American University of Beirut. Ms. Khoury begins by explaining how psychological support can be given when people are on the move.
Psychology can be involved at many different levels. It can be involved at the beginning of the crisis with refugees going through maybe transition countries into preparing refugees towards more resettlement countries and how to help through the process of preparation, of arriving to the country, and then the resettlement.
Yeah, you know, there's a myth out there. It was actually promulgated by a famous psychologist named Abraham Maslow, and the idea was that you meet physical needs first and belongingness and psychological needs come later. I work in emergency situations worldwide, and my experience is quite the opposite. So, for example, for a young child, that child may not be able to feed, clothe, you know, or get medical care, take care of himself, because his mother is completely overwhelmed. And I think that we have the first global consensus guidelines, and basically they call for multi-level supports. It's not all therapy. It's about being able to locate family members you're separated from. It's about generating school supports, psychological first aid. I wouldn't say that psychology occupies a privileged place, but I'd say that it is an essential ingredient of a comprehensive approach.
And what challenges are there in implementing the use of psychology in these post-conflict situations?
The first one is the lack of resources. We don't have enough psychologists or mental health professionals. Another one is actually a lot of refugees have never had contact with mental health professionals, and there's a lot of stigma associated with it.
Well, sometimes we get banned from the areas in greatest need. And the idea is that people who work on psychosocial and mental health issues, child protection issues, we have eyes for human rights violations, and that doesn't make the perpetrators very happy. I'd say also that there's a tendency in emergency settings to set up parallel support. So sometimes well-intended psychologists come in and they'll set up counseling services and so on, but they don't fit with the existing health system. They end up not being sustainable, and lots of times they erode some of the natural supports that are already there.
So what can the UN and the international community do to raise awareness of the benefits of psychology in these settings?
Having psychology as actually part of the services provided, part of the teams, highlighting the role and the importance of mental health in providing, you know, refugee help. of course, giving resources, allowing more people to actually be trained in these things and have giving access to refugees for that. So I think the UN and other NGOs have a big role to play, actually.
You've been listening to UN Gender Focus from the United Nations in New York. Thanks for listening. I'm Deanne Penn.